Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an apparent outbreak of panic inside David Cameron's ruling Conservative government in the UK as Thursday's referendum on Scottish independence comes down to the wire, with Cameron throwing sweetener after sweetener into the mix to lure Scottish voters away from a yes vote. Polly Toynbee, a columnist for the UK Guardian and a former BBC social affairs editor and associate editor of The Independent, joins us to discuss last-minute efforts by a Tory government that is deeply unpopular in Scotland to persuade Scottish voters that they are better off with Britain. Then we'll look further into the fateful vote in Scotland that has tremendous geopolitical implications for the future of the UK, which will be diminished further if the Scots vote yes, because the opposition Labour Party will lose 40 seats to Scotland and will therefore be unlikely to win the next election in Britain, allowing the Tories to proceed with the suicidal referendum Cameron has promised for Britain to leave the European Union, further diminishing the UK into irrelevance. One of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to everyday life, Toby Miller, joins us from the UK to discuss the political failures that have led to a resurgence of nationalism. Then finally, following testimony by the Secretary of Defence and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs before the Senate Armed Services Committee, where General Dempsey said that under certain conditions, American boots on the ground might be required in Iraq, we will speak with William Hartung, the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and author of Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War. We will discuss the likelihood that a third U.S. war in Iraq will be the next big meal ticket for military contractors. And joining us now is Polly Toynbee, who is a columnist for the UK Guardian. She was formerly BBC social affairs editor, columnist and associate editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. Welcome to Background Briefing, Polly Toynbee.
Hello.
So tell me, in terms of this referendum, which is only a couple of days away on Thursday, and it apparently is quite a nail-biter, and it has both the Prime Minister of England, David Cameron, very nervous, and the Labour Party, who apparently, if this passes, will become a minority party and perhaps never get back into the majority. So there seems to be a lot riding on this politically. But how did David Cameron set this up in the first place? It seemed to have been set up as a very stark either-or choice.
It was impossible for him to refuse a referendum once the Scottish National Party had won their elections in Scotland. They would have gone ahead and had a referendum anyway. Cameron's mistake was he thought that no would win it, and he didn't want to give away too much devolution. The Scottish Nationalists had wanted a third option on the paper, which was called Devo Max, Maximum Devolution, which would have been a whole list of things they wanted short of actual independence. Cameron was so confident that his side would win that he ruled it out and now bitterly regrets it. And as a result, this week you've seen all three party leaders dashing up to Scotland to offer them almost everything. It amounts to kind of home rule. Extraordinary freedoms to spend, to borrow, to tax as they like. Wouldn't seem extraordinary perhaps to an American state, but within the United Kingdom, quite exceptional freedoms that will burst the bounds of the very austere spending limits that have been set in London.
Well, my understanding is much of the campaigning has been focused in the UK and not so much in Scotland. And there's been criticism of Cameron for not spending enough time there and not making his case up there. And celebrities, I understand, like David Beckham and others in Trafalgar Square have been calling for a no vote. If what you've just told us is the case, then the Scottish voters must be sensing a sense of panic on the side of the no vote. And this may be counterproductive.
About 10 days ago, panic suddenly seized the entire political system across the United Kingdom, particularly in Westminster, when for the first time a poll put the yes side ahead. Up until then, there'd been a very complacent sense that no would win reasonably comfortably. And so the Westminster politicians had really stayed out of the way. I think Cameron and the Conservatives deliberately and rightly stayed out of the way because they are so detested in Scotland, where they have no MPs, where there aren't any Conservatives in Scotland, And that really is the cause of the resurgence of Scottish nationalism. You know, we never voted for this government. We didn't vote for Mrs. Thatcher either. We have governments imposed on us that are not at all like our own politics. And so the idea that Cameron would be an asset in the No campaign, they kept him away. But now things are so desperate that it looks as if he doesn't care. So he feels he has to go up there. He talks. He doesn't dare speak in public meetings. He can only talk to very select groups because he would be shouted down in public meetings. And it's rather extraordinary that, you know, the British Prime Minister cannot appear in public in Scotland.
Again, I'm speaking with Polly Toynbee, who's a columnist for the UK Guardian. She was formerly BBC Social Affairs Editor, columnist and Associate Editor of The Independent and co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. Recently, in the in his column in the New York Times, the Nobel economist Paul Krugman warned Scotland against taking this step, using the case of, say, Canada having a sovereign currency but being right next door to the United States. And in contrast, Spain, which is a part of the euro, doesn't have that flexibility and independence in terms of a currency. So he was basically saying it's an absolute recipe for disaster to have political independence without economic independence. And there is a certain contradiction here, surely, that the Scottish nationalists want political independence, but they're prepared to accept the Queen and the pound sterling.
I think this was the Scottish nationalist Alex Salmond's calculation, that there is a small-c conservative strong element in Scotland that is royalist and that understands the pound and would be alarmed at the thought of a new currency. And it would have taken several years to set up a new currency and many more years before you could develop the international confidence to borrow against it. So that he felt there was only the option of having the pound. He hopes to have it, you know, as agreed across the border, but if not, he can borrow it. I mean, he can just use it in the way that Panama uses the dollar. But this is very much the worst of all worlds, as Krugman says. You can't devalue your currency if you want to. You are at the whim of the Westminster government and the Westminster Treasury without having any say in those policy decisions. So I think that that will be, if it goes no, I think that will probably be the clincher. They realise they would, as Krugman suggests, live through a period of quite tough austerity, even worse than we're having in England, and in order to satisfy their nationalist aspirations. So it's, you know, the heart says, let's be free, even if it costs us. The head says it's going to cost us quite a lot. They'll be perfectly viable, but they'd have a hard 10 years.
Well, my understanding, though, Polly Toynbee, is that if you have a no vote, that this will lead directly to a referendum that Cameron has agreed to, under pressure from the conservative right wing, to have a referendum on membership in the EU, which is, it seems to be in many ways more significant, perhaps even than the Scottish referendum. So if he wins and gets a no vote, that's one matter. But if he loses, wouldn't that be very complicated? Because on the one hand, he'd be probably blamed, but on the other hand, Labour Party would be wiped out. And if they get in the next elections, there would be no referendum. But if the Conservatives get in the next election, there would be a referendum. So is that in the cards?
You're right. This is perplexing because anybody outsider looking at the way the seats fall out would say, why does Cameron want to keep Scotland? It doesn't make any sense. The 41 seats in our Parliament are Labour seats that come from Scotland. Wouldn't it be better to be rid of them? And England would be Conservative for the foreseeable future. But there is another element to Conservatism in England, which is, and in Britain, which is, it is also called the Unionist Party. It is the party of Britain. And he will go down in history as the man who lost Scotland. And he knows that'll be his epitaph. Quite likely his own party might force him to resign if he loses Scotland, because there is a great sense of national tragedy. It's not just totting up the number of seats and the immediate political calculation. It really is a disaster. We will be a much smaller country, we'll be a weaker country. It'll be harder for us to hold on to things such as our seat on the UN Security Council. We're not quite sure why we've still got it, but this would be another reason for some why other countries might challenge our right to it. I think, as a matter of national prestige, it will be a humiliation for him. But you're quite right to say that, on the other hand, his party does gain when it comes to general elections. And of course, if he were to win the next general election, then he is obliged to have this insane referendum that he has agreed to pull us out of Europe. He doesn't want to do that either. I don't think he wants to go down in history as the man who sent Britain sailing off into the middle of nowhere all by itself. But his party is now so seized by a kind of anti-European mania that it's quite unlikely that he could win it. And then he's really a loser all round. He will be the man who separated England from anything that was sane or internationalist-minded and sent us off as a little offshore island, probably to become a kind of Luxembourg or a tax haven, weak and, a haven for oligarchs and corrupt people around the world to live the London luxury life and impoverish the rest of the country.
Well, this sounds like a pair of geopolitical suicide pacts that you're talking about. I mean, how much traction does the far right and the nostalgic empire people and the xenophobes have? Surely the majority of the British want to be in Europe and want to be relevant.
The move against Europe has been very strong, partly because of Rupert Murdoch. He controls 40% of the readership of the British press, big popular newspapers like The Sun, also The Times, Sunday Times. And he has always been rapidly anti-European, as the only force that's really had any check on his empire and restricted some of his monopolistic ambitions. And so he's always pumped out anti-European. But so have our other right-wing newspapers. We have our entire media really is run by four maverick, very far right-wing press barons who are mostly not British. And they are all anti-European. I think that since the recession, anti-immigration feeling is strong. And what underpins the anti-Europeanism amongst a lot of white working class feeling is that our jobs have all gone to Poles and to East European foreigners of one kind or another. And they they say if we were out of Europe, we could put back our borders. We wouldn't have to have all these East Europeans taking our jobs. And that's really what underpins the sentiment, the anti-European feeling. And I think it's, touch and go. Business would say, of course, we can't leave. But there is, a strong anti-establishment feeling since the recession. And they might not listen to what business said any more than they listen to what Cameron said.
Well, that's extraordinary, Polly Toynbee, to think that Rupert Murdoch has had that kind of malignant influence over Britain's politics through his power of the press. And frankly, it's the same thing has happened here in the United States. We have political gridlock here, largely in part because of Murdoch's favouring and encouraging xenophobia and the so-called Tea Party who have brought about this gridlock. And you wonder what his motives are in terms of being the sort of wrecking crew of both the United States and the UK, short of making money. Have you ever figured anything further out about what motivates this man?
An entirely malevolent force. I think love of power is part of it, that he's been able to twist successive prime ministers round his finger and then writes dismissive things about them. He gave an interview saying, when Blair and Brown were in power, saying how annoying it is having to go to London because you've always got to see both Blair and Brown. If you see one, you have to see the other. This sort of patronising attitude that he is the puppet master and all politicians are merely his puppets. And to a large extent, Conservative and Labour politicians, that's been true. Even our mavericks, even Nigel Farage of UKIP, our anti-European party, which is now the sort of most extreme Tea Party version that we have here, even he has made the trip to New York to go and see Murdoch. Even Alex Salmond, the Scottish Nationalists, he has been to see Murdoch, and Murdoch has come to Scotland to see him. I think it is partly that power mania, but also it is underpinned by business sense. He has always felt that Europe has put a spanner in his works for a lot of the things he's wanted to take over. When he first launched Sky Television, he had to obey European rules that said he couldn't launch it on purely American content. At that point, he had no British content. Mrs. Thatcher insisted that Europe changed the rules for him. So he forced her to do that. And so he launched Sky, and Sky is now the dominant broadcaster and far outspending the BBC and, you know, taking over the broadcasting universe just as he's taken over the press, the newspaper universe. Power and money, that's what it is.
But in terms of his position or his newspapers and media's position on the Scottish referendum, where does he come down on that?
He's sitting on the fence. He's giving tantalising indications that The Sun might come out, which is quite sells a lot in Scotland, might come out for independence. In the end, he always liked to be on the side of the winner. So he sees which way the wind blows. I think he's must be a bit agonised at the moment because nobody quite knows which way the wind blows. This is not an easy one for pollsters to call. Huge numbers of people have registered to vote, 97%. There hasn't been another vote like this to compare it with, and the pollsters are a bit at sea. If he thinks yes, we'll win, he'll go for it. If not, he probably won't.
So just in closing then, what about the issues of the nuclear weapons in Scotland, where the Trident bases are? And my understanding is that the Scots want them out and that this is probably concerning the United States because of NATO's partnership and the Tridents being a part of, in fact, that is the, I guess it's an American weapon, but it's one of the more expensive investments in the British military. Is there another place for them to go? How much? Because I spoke the other day with a political scientist at St. Andrews, William Walker, who made the point, which I thought was startling. He said, you know, there is nobody up here in Scotland from the American embassy. We have one consular official in Scotland, and they're getting all of their, the Americans are getting all their information via Westminster and the embassy in London, and they're not here on the ground, and they may well be wake up with a terrible surprise. Is the Trident nuclear weapons issue a big issue?
I think it is quite a big issue. I think that Scotland, a lot of Scotland is instinctively anti-Trident. On the other hand, Scotland has a very strong connection with the forces. It's always provided large numbers of the British forces. There are also quite a lot of jobs attached to it. It will be interesting to see whether he strikes a deal, makes some kind of token gesture, but gets some money perhaps for keeping it. The alternative is, you know, a new base could be built, but it would be phenomenally expensive. Replacing Trident is anyway going to be so expensive, it might really tip the balance to not replacing Trident. Depends very much who's in power. If, of course, in May, Labour is in power, which it may well be, it may be that they'd use this opportunity to say, you know what, we don't really need to replace a permanent at-sea capability. We could kind of have a nuclear bomb in a cupboard somewhere and be technically a nuclear power, but not much. And they might head that way when they look at the appalling costs of building a new base. And already the cost of Trident is astronomical.
Well, this is obviously fascinating from a journalistic point of view, but somewhat terrifying from a geopolitical point of view.
It is. It's very frightening. You wouldn't think that Scotland, 5 million people, could be so important, but it is, and it's important, you know, in all kinds of ways. But for the sense of British identity, yes, I think a lot of people will be heartbroken if they go, and the politics are very uncertain as to where it leaves us.
Well, Polly Toynbee, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Polly Toynbee, who's a columnist for The Guardian. She was formerly BBC Social Affairs Editor, columnist and Associate Editor of The Independent, co-editor of The Washington Monthly, and a reporter and feature writer for The Observer. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the tremendous geopolitical implications of the fateful vote in Scotland this Thursday.
This does not reflect your view. You should understand that those who run and fight this all shot on this land. And they'd rather you believed in Coronation Street. Capers in the war, circulation in sales, newspapers. Could it be an infringement of the freedom of the press to print pictures of women stained by undress?
Don't need to change the future's odd. You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote. Give us your vote.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the UK is Toby Miller, who's one of the world's leading analysts on popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Captured the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
It's good to be with you, Ian.
And you're a couple of days away from a tectonic vote in Scotland that comes out of, I believe, a political frustration in Scotland that they are represented by the Conservative Party that's almost invisible. Somebody said the other day there are more pandas in Scotland than there are Tories. But it has tremendous geopolitical consequences. Not the least is the Britain's Trident nuclear deterrent is going to be booted out of Scotland. But my understanding, and I just spoke with Polly Toynbee of the UK Guardian about the consequences of a yes vote would basically wipe out the Labour Party, make them, they would never be competitive, at least for a long time, because they'd lose 40 seats. So therefore, the Labour people would lose the next election, which would mean that Cameron would be re-elected, the Tories would be re-elected, and they would then go ahead with Cameron's idiotic and reckless promise to his right-wing constituency that they would have a referendum in the UK on staying in the EU. And because of the malignant efforts of Rupert Murdoch to poison the polity in England with this anti-European, racist, anti-immigrant xenophobia that this horrible export from Australia has imposed upon the British people, as well as here in the United States on the American people through Fox News, would therefore mean that the British would vote themselves out of the EU and end up being completely irrelevant, a minor power.
Well, Ian, we both know how malignant Australian expats and exports can be in the United States and elsewhere. But in all seriousness, you raise some very important issues. There's been a United Kingdom for over 300 years. It's Northern Ireland, England, Scotland and Wales. The Scots do vote in 2 days' time in a referendum that's an in-out, one-shot, 50-50 decision about whether to depart from the United Kingdom. As you say, there's a major implication for NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is run by the US with a bunch of European, you know, lapdogs working for it to control Eastern, Central and Western Europe, because Trident, which is Britain's nuclear so-called deterrent, i.e. offense, is located there. There are major implications, as you say, for the European Union, and also for the possibility of a social democratic Britain, because, as you rightly indicate, a number of Labour Party seats are Scottish. Now, the difficulty is that in terms of term limits, 2015 is when there will next be a British election. 2016 is when the effect of the referendum will happen. So we might have a situation where we have an election that the Labour Party wins, either on its own or in coalition, next year. But then the year after is unable to govern with, because suddenly, think of it in US terms, about a tenth of the Congress simply departs. So there are major implications on all those fronts. And then there's the question of oil and natural gas, because as people may know, North Sea oil, one of the major areas for oil exploration and production that was shared pretty much between Norway and Britain, is Scottish, in inverted commas. It's also dying out as a set of active fields. What happens to that? And then there are questions of the pound. What happens to this very important international monetary source, sterling? And then there's the question, as you rightly mentioned, of membership of the European Union. What happens if Cameron has this referendum, the next referendum, to take Britain out? And what happens if Scotland seeks readmission to the EU and other countries like Spain and Belgium, other countries that are facing secessionist movements, basically say, sorry, you can't join, because they don't want, for example, in the case of the Spanish Catalonia, to become an independent entity that has access to the EU.
So why is this all happening, though? I mean, one of the things that Polly Toynbee suggested was that this irrationality, just as we have this irrational Tea Party in this country that has created political gridlock, and it's been largely generated and nurtured by Rupert Murdoch and Fox News, they've had this incredible malignant effect on our politics here. And she was making the case that in the UK, all of this anti-European stuff and anti-immigrant stuff has all been whipped up by Murdoch. It's not inherently there, and it's certainly not a part of what the business community want, what the national security people want, what the, you know, traditional, you know, what the academic community want. It's just this rabble that's been roused up by this Australian expat.
Well, Polly Toynbee may be right about that, but in terms of the Scottish independence movement, one of the things it's talking about is being much more open to foreigners, particularly refugees, than Britain is in general. What we're seeing in this case of the Scottish referendum, though, is more complicated, I think, than that. It's a number of things. First of all, though the Scots were amongst the first victims of British imperialism, they were also, of course, many of its ambassadors and workers, particularly in the area of accountancy and diplomacy. So they've had both a bit in on, they've been part of UK imperialism, even as they were subjects of it. In addition to that, they are very angry with the Conservative Party. Listeners may be familiar with the idea of a poll tax, one of Milton Friedman's great favourites, the idea that one of the ways in which you would be able to raise public revenue was by taxing the number of people who lived in a household. This is called poll tax. This was tried out by the Tories, the Conservative Party, the equivalent of the Republicans, in Britain in the late 80s, early 90s in Scotland. And it's led to a situation where, as you said in your intro, the now ruling Conservative Party has virtually no representation in Scotland whatsoever. However, the Labour Party, which was one of the beneficiaries of this, which is the Social Democratic Front of the Union, trade union movement and others, including leftist intellectuals, equivalent more or less to the Democrats in the US, benefited. But because, like the Democrats, the British Labour Party has become the creature of neoliberalism and business, it ceased to be able to hold on to the electorate in Scotland, particularly in the working class, that was the key to its success in the mid to late 80s and the early 90s. So now, the alternative the Scots face, particularly working class people, is, of course, nationalism. And there is this thing called the Scottish Nationalist Party, very successful in Scotland, now ruling to the extent that there is devolution of the country, if you can call it that, and in favour of the yes vote for secession that takes place in 2 days. So basically what we've seen is the Conservatives, equivalent of the Republicans, shooting themselves in the foot 25 years ago by trying out this very regressive poll tax in Scotland, and the Labour Party, the Social Democrats, equivalent of the Democrats, shooting themselves in the foot by following neoliberal policies. So the natural inheritor of power that that vacuum creates is a nationalism. I should say, however, that it, to reemphasize the point, this is not a nationalism that is necessarily xenophobic. In fact, it's less xenophobic in lots of ways than, for example, England, where I live.
Well, that was I was referring to English xenophobia. At least that's what Polly Toynbee was talking about, and Nigel Farage,
right.
and that's the constituency that Murdoch has whipped up, just as he's whipped up the equally xenophobic and far right wing Tea Party in this country.
Right.
So, how's he going to come down on Scottish nationalism then?
Well, it's very interesting, Ian, because we're in a situation where Murdoch himself, who of course claims to be anti-establishment and has Scottish heritage, his great uncle, Sir Walter Murdoch, a great Australian journalist and literary critic, was an émigré from Scotland to Victoria and then to Western Australia. Murdoch, who is part of this claim that he is not a member of the establishment, he's all in favour of devolution, of independence for Scotland. Ironically, given that, of course, he is totally in cahoots with the establishment. His newspapers have been much more ambivalent, but it seems possible that the Scottish Sun, which is one of the daily newspapers under his hegemony, will come out in favour of a yes vote. We're not clear about that yet. By and large, the bourgeois media, the major financial institutions, the big investors, and all the leading corporations that are Scottish or have money in Scotland are becoming part of a moral panic or an intense social anxiety about devolution. And we're seeing a run on the pound that's quite disastrous as a consequence of this. So what's interesting here is that Murdoch, whom we in the United States might think of as representative of the classic kind of international capitalist class, he's actually turning out to be a Scottish nationalist. And he's got a different perspective, a different view from many of the big corporations, particularly the banks. So I'm not trying to give Uncle Rupert a free pass. Clearly he's a monster, and sue me if you want, Rupert. But he's got a bee in his bonnet about sticking it up, the royal family and all the rest of it. Having said that, people may want to know in the United States that if Scotland votes yes, it will still be a monarchy. They've already announced they want Queen Elizabeth II to be the Queen of Scots.
Again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who's in the UK. He's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. So how then do you explain, though, in the broader sense, assuming that you have a yes vote in Scotland, which makes the Labour Party in England a minority party, empowers the Tories, leads to a referendum for the Brits to get out of the European Union and become even more irrelevant. They lose Scotland and they're diminished, and then they diminish themselves with another act of geopolitical suicide by voting themselves out of the EU. Do they have any idea? I mean, the British establishment, are they going to allow that? I mean, I thought the old boy network was such that they'd be able to pull strings behind the scenes and not allow rabbles like these right-wing xenophobes like Nigel Farage to have their day in the sun.
Well, Nigel Farage is head of the United Kingdom Independence Party, which ironically enough has no representation in the equivalent of Congress here, but does have representation in the European Union. And really its only policy is anti-European Union. Now, it's quite possible that we will have a referendum. My suspicion is that Cameron, the British Prime Minister and leader of the Tory party, if he's still Prime Minister, will actually vote in favour of staying in the EU, and certainly all major corporate entities will vote in favour of that. But think about the United States and the last 20 years of a completely insane Republican Party that is basically, you know, on the booze and off the wheel, off the rails. It's not really doing the bidding of corporate America, which in many cases is quite a rational entity. You've got the same difficulty here. There are, as you imply, xenophobic, racist, frightened white men at the top of the Tory party who are frightened by Romanians, Bulgarians and all the rest of them. The new racism in Britain is not about Afro-Caribbeans or South Asians from India or Pakistan. The new racism is about people from Poland and Romania, or people who are Gitano or Romani or travellers or gypsies. That's the real problem. And this is a very important subset of white, particularly male conservatism in this country. So it's getting its day in the sun, as you rightly put it. Will corporate Britain accept this? Will the establishment accept it? As you also suggest, Ian, they're crazy if they do. Regrettably, though, there are those on the left who are also opposed to membership of the European Union on the grounds that the best route for socialism is a nationalist one. Well, we all remember socialism in one country thanks to Uncle Joe and the Soviet Union. Let's hope that doesn't come to pass.
So is there then, given this uncertainty, again, I find it so extraordinary that these huge self-inflicted tectonic political upheavals are taking place in a democratic way, needless to say. And so, you know, you take your life into your hands before a jury of your peers, and you take your life in your hands when you go to the polls, I guess. But what
there's
I find...
No going back, Ian. If there's no going back, if there's a yes vote, on Thursday, then that's it. The Constitution is broken. And remember that in our case here in the UK, as opposed to the US instance, there is no written Constitution. So the Constitution, understood, in inverted commas, is broken. It's over. It is a very dramatic decision. And what's most interesting about it is that in the last few weeks, the people who've made the difference, because initially this was very much going to be a no vote, the people who've made the difference as it swung towards the yes side are women. Women have increasingly become compelled by the nationalist argument. And the nationalist argument is basically that the right of politics cannot be trusted, trust us. Now, the problem with all of this is that, on the one hand, it's got some good policies, the yes movement, for example, getting rid of Trident, this nuclear so-called deterrent that Britain has. But on the other hand, it is a bunch of wish lists that can never be achieved. They will probably not have proper access to the pound. They will probably not have access to the European Union. They will probably not have access to all the money that makes our socialized health service work. And they will probably have such a loss of investment that even though they're talking about reducing corporate tax rates to attract such investment, they will see the Royal Bank of Scotland, for example, and plenty of other major financial institutions head south as fast as their legs will carry them, at the same time as some of their other major investors like BP, the big oil extractor and manufacturer, departing as well. So there is a switch, a very interesting gender switch. It's based, I think, on correctly understanding that the Labour Party has betrayed the working class and ordinary people, correctly understanding that the Conservative Party fails to represent them, but incorrectly thinking that nationalism is the way forward. And economically, nationalism probably won't be.
Well, just in closing, though, I'm very apprehensive about the upcoming midterm elections here in the United States, where, as you pointed out, Toby Miller, the Republicans have gone mad over the last couple of decades. They're simply the traditional Republicans of old are extinct, and you have this rabble of xenophobes and small-town corrupt lawyers and, you know, hirelings and whores of plutocrats like the Koch brothers who are running the Republican Party. And yet they are likely to be rewarded by the American voters who, by and large, aren't going to show up to vote. And therefore, by default, the Republicans will end up controlling the Senate. Obama will be finished. And the country will go to the dogs at warp speed.
Well, you've got to remember in the case of the United States that the decision not to participate in conventional political terms is in some sense a rational one. For many minorities, members of the working class, what party that is in any sense credible as a governing body represents them? The Democrats have long relied on the notion that African Americans, that Jews, that Latinos will support it. What has the Democratic Party ever done for these groups? Very, very, very little. And the same applies to the Labour Party here in Britain. So unless these entities decide that getting into bed with big business may make sense for their financial survival as political parties, but doesn't make sense in policy terms, and until they actually face up to the need to show good faith in their constituents, then we will have cynicism, apathy, and lack of participation. And one of the ironies of this referendum here in Scotland is that it seems as though, for the first time in decades, we're going to have a massive turnout, and it's nationalism that's leading to that turnout. That's a frightening thought in and of itself.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Always good to talk to you, Ian.
Likewise, Toby. And again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who's one of the world's leading analysts on popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into how the third U.S. war in Iraq will be the next big meal ticket for military contractors. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Hartung, Director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His books include Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Prophets of War, that's P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And General Dempsey, alongside Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And General Dempsey said that if this international coalition against the Islamic State didn't get its act together, if it fails to be true, then there are threats to the United States. Then I, of course, would go back to the president and make a recommendation that may include the use of U.S. military ground forces. In other words, boots on the ground, the very thing that the president has promised that he won't do. So it's a somewhat hypothetical, but what do you think the impact of that is?
Well, I hope people are paying attention or will hear about it, because if you look at the polls, there's a lot of support for airstrikes, still not very much support for a ground combat role. And Obama's been kind of trying to skirt the issue, and he's saying it's not going to be another Iraq, and we won't have boots on the ground. Now Dempsey's made it clear that there are situations where he would recommend to Obama to do that, including things like if the ISIS forces were to recapture the dam in Mosul and they needed to drive them out, he would consider putting U.S. troops in the midst of that. He had various cute terms like accompanying troops as opposed to combat troops, but we all knew what he meant.
So in contrast to this coalition that Secretary of State Kerry was building in Paris, 26 nations, including Russia and China, there seems to be a sort of at least an attempt. Of course, Turkey is conspicuously absent from this regional anti-ISIS coalition. But the government of Iraq itself, in contrast, while other people are trying to come to Iraq's rescue, the government in Baghdad is displaying its dysfunction yet again. The Iraqi new prime minister saw two of his nominations for the head of defense and the interior ministry rejected by the parliament.
Yes, I think this notion that Iraq is making progress towards a government that will respect the diverse communities in Iraq is wishful thinking. Dempsey kind of referred to that. He said, you know, without effective allies on the ground, this isn't going to work, you know, this war in Iraq and Syria. But who are those effective partners? You know, the Iraqi government, as you said, cannot get its act together. Sectarianism is still a strong force there. The moderates in Syria probably don't exist, and if they do, it's not clear that they can have a big impact on the situation. So it all sort of leads up to the idea that there's going to be a gap between their rhetoric and what they're able to accomplish. And I think that'll be the moment where this issue of boots on the ground will become even more of a contentious issue.
So is it possible then, given the president's reluctance to have boots on the ground and the sort of passing of the hypotheticals that took place before the Senate Armed Services Committee with Secretary of Defense and General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, And, of course, there were anti-war protests that also reminded, I guess, these two military leaders that not all of the American people are thrilled about this situation. My sense is that what's likely to happen here is that this war is going to be a new gravy train for military contractors, because they are those kind of boots on the ground that we can deny.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, they could sort of argue, well, they're not troops, as they've tried to do in the past, or just trying to ignore them. I mean, you know, there were hundreds of casualties among private contractors during the Iraq War prior to the one that's starting now, and that was rarely discussed. You know, so those casualties were not resulting in a political cost to the Bush or Obama administrations. So this kind of situation, if they're promising no troops, it's kind of ripe for hiring contractors. And there's been some reference in the business press to the contractors chomping at the bit to get a piece of this business.
Well, apparently in 2008, there were 242,558 contractors working in countries for U.S. Central Command that include Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Pakistan, and Yemen. And, you know, as far as I know, there wasn't a lot going on, except in perhaps in Afghanistan. That's 250,000 contractors on the government payroll. So it's only going to increase. I mean, what are these guys doing?
Well, they have used them for pretty much everything, from doing the laundry, to serving food, to digging latrines, to carrying guns, to guarding the embassy, to training troops. So there's a whole gamut, but pretty much anything that the Army might do, the contractors have been doing. I mean, they don't operate in, you know, large units the way the U.S. military does, but they certainly have carried guns, have been on the front line, have suffered casualties. So it's sort of a shadow army with a few, you know, nuanced differences, but in essence, that's what's going on.
So give us some more information, if you can, William, on what the business press is saying about contractors salivating and chomping at the bit to get in on the gravy train. Because I've heard figures that this new war, let's call it Iraq 3, there's about $30 billion possibly in the pipeline?
Well, they've been very crafty about exactly how much they're going to spend. But there is a lot of money sitting around in the war budget that was allegedly for winding down the war in Afghanistan. Some estimates, there's $20 or $30 billion dollars sloshing around there that could be tapped. They're going to keep that high level for that war fund going, you know, into next year. So even if they didn't appropriate another dime, they have perhaps tens of billions of dollars they could spend. And not too many of the contractors have gone on record saying, you know, show me the money. But there's been, you know, off the record, there's been conversations, and business analysts have projected the notion that, you know, a company like DynCorp that does training could do very well in this scenario.
Well, DynCorp has been doing well in Iraq since the U.S. withdrew. But what kind of culpability do they have for the fact that this Iraqi army that the U.S. has spent something like, what, $20 billion on, collapsed as these Mad Max marauders came in from the Islamic State, and all that equipment ended up in the hands of the Islamic State, and now a lot of it's being used in Syria as well as Iraq?
Well, the only senator who asked a question about that in the Armed Services Committee today was Senator Manchin of West Virginia. But he didn't tie it to the role of the private contractors. He just said, you know, if we've done $20 billion of training, if it failed so miserably, why do we think it's going to do better in Syria? But DynCorp, which played a central role in that ineffectual training, was not held to account and may well not be.
So this is the $500 million that Obama's asked for to train the Syrians, even though we're not sure who these people are. The CIA, and actually it's the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, said that there are up to 1,500 different militias fighting in Syria. So assuming we know who's on our side and we can vet them, and then this money, $500 million, can be used to train and arm them, what's happening in terms of discussions about the Iraqi army and training it again, because that seems to be where most of the focus is so far. Nobody has a clear policy on Syria, but they seem to, at least, you know, the U.S. Is involved with the Peshmerga in the Kurdish north, and they're flying every day. They're flying air sorties. I think they're up to about 200 so far.
That's right. And, you know, once again, the debate about Syria has taken a little bit of a eye off the question of how much money is going to pour into Iraq in the short term for this kind of training. But, you know, they've said that they've spent a few hundred million dollars so far. But if they are really talking about degrading and destroying ISIS, assuming that's even possible, then billions or tens of billions will follow over the next several years. You know, Dempsey also said this is a generational struggle. So we're back to the kind of rhetoric we had under Bush about the global war on terror, you know, going on for our lifetime. So, you know, that kind of commitment would indicate a long-term increase, not just in war funding, but they're now trying to push against the budget caps on the Pentagon's base budget, which have been in effect for a few years now.
Well, I recall also General Petraeus said that it would take generations to win the war, in quotes, in Afghanistan. And clearly, we're getting out of there. So what's your sense then of how much this train has left the station, and what are the checks and balances here? I mean, it seems with these, if the Senate doesn't even ask questions about DynCorp, who trained up the Iraqi military that collapsed, and now we're talking about needing to train them up again, and presumably DynCorp will be even getting more of the gravy train. I just get the sense that there's little to no oversight over military contractors.
Well, there's a handful of members who have pointed out that this could be a problem. Representative Barbara Lee, who's a solid progressive, has called for full debate before they go ahead and arm the Syrian rebels. Senator McCaskill from Missouri, who was involved with a wartime contracting commission that was trying to look at the corruption among contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan, has talked today about putting strict limits on sort of the kinds of contracts that were let out, but not about the issue of whether it was appropriate to contract this kind of training in the first place. So, you know, I think some questions will be asked, but the overwhelming sense you got from the hearing today and from members of Congress is there's not that many of them willing to stand up and say this makes no sense. And, you know, maybe that'll change as the things go south. But at the moment, there's not a lot of people standing up in Congress and being counted against widening the war.
And there's no pushback from the military itself. I understand there's always been a pretty contentious relationship with the contractors. A part of it is that they poach all of those people that the U.S. taxpayers train, like the Special Forces guys, and then they, you know, peel them off and pay them a lot more. And, of course, they charge the government 10 times for whatever they pay their guys. We learned that from the Edward Snowden contract. So is the military sort of ambivalent about the contractors, or on the other hand, they seem to be also ambivalent about getting into the Middle East again, don't they? They're pretty burned from Iraq and from Afghanistan, my understanding is.
Yeah, it's hard to read because, of course, you know, the top leadership, like Dempsey, have to, you know, speak with the program. But I do believe that, you know, even he would prefer not to go full force into this conflict. And I think at the lower ranks, people we're not hearing from are more skeptical of yet another war in Iraq. And, you know, whether shifting to contractors would cause the kind of, you know, tensions that we saw during Bush's Iraq war, I'm not sure. I mean, they were fighting, you know, side to side, and it was easy to see that this person doing more or less the same work as you're doing for a contractor was making 10 times as much or more. I think it might depend on what the mix is of military personnel and contractors as they ramp this thing up. But if they do do that, I think the same kind of tensions will emerge.
But at this point, it doesn't look like there are too many allies ponying up. Nobody's offering boots on the ground except the Australian Prime Minister offering 600 troops. And it looks as though the most logical assuming that you can't entirely rely on the Peshmerga, and you certainly can't rely on the Shiite militias or the Iranians, who, by the way, IRGC people, the Revolutionary Guard Corps people, have actually boots on the ground inside Iraq. So that's what's so counterintuitive about what this policy is, this military strategy to take on the Islamic State with the hated Iranians and the hated government in Baghdad, who have already indicated that they're indiscriminate in their bombing. So you'll have enormous amounts of collateral damage that the Islamic State will be able to advertise. And we have excluded the Iraqi tribes, the Sunni tribes, the people who saved Bush and Cheney with the so-called surge. They're being sold out. It just feels as if the only people who are going to make out in this catastrophe are the contractors.
Well, they're the ones who don't have to suffer great consequence. I mean, you know, there's people at risk, but the amount of money they're getting in exchange for that is quite fantastic. And, of course, they're not responsible for making policy. They're just responsible for coming to this breach and cashing in to the degree that they're able to. So, you know, it's hard to see a path, a military path, to defeating, degrading ISIS, as President Obama has said is the goal now. But it's easy to see how things could be made worse between collateral damage to civilians, between getting into the middle of a multi-sided civil war, between giving ISIS a recruiting phrase, you know, as U.S. Involvement escalates. It'll bear watching, but the contractor sort of out certainly suggests itself as a possibility that may be seized upon by the administration.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Sir William Hartung. I guess we will wait and see whether General Dempsey's ambiguous half promise that boots on the ground might be necessary will come to pass. But at this point, do you think the American people are going to make their voices heard?
Well, there was a day of action today. Anti-war groups like Win Without War and Friends of International Association, Peace Action, some of the move-on groups, at least to sort of bombard the Congress with messages about people not wanting to go to war. And, of course, some people penetrated the hearing room and at least, you know, got to say a few things before they were kicked out. But I think it's not clear how much of that it will take to reach the broader public. I think certainly the elements of the existing peace movement are pulling together and mobilizing against this war. But I think the average person is still sort of back in this notion of, you know, they're bloody, they're awful, they beheaded Americans, and we have to do something about it. Even though one poll showed that many of the people who thought we should do things like airstrikes didn't think they were actually going to work. So it's almost sort of like, we just have to do something, we need to get revenge, and we'll worry about the consequences later. So I think there's still a lot of education to be done if there's going to be enough pushback to have an impact on Obama.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, William Hartung.
Yes, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William Hartung, who's director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His books include Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Prophets of War, that's P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.